Welcome to Inflection Point, conversations with women changing the status quo. I'm Lauren Schiller. Today on Inflection Point, privacy is privacy, right?
When you create a rule that privacy should work a certain way, there could be lots of unintended consequences.
That's today on Inflection Point. There's an old saying, when in Rome, do as the Romans do. But if your company is also in Paris, Shanghai, and Peoria, you need someone to balance the culture and laws of all your users. One of those people is Nikki Jackson Colasso, the Director of Public Policy at Instagram. Thanks for coming in today, Nikki.
Thank you for having me. This is so exciting.
I think first things first, there are definitely listeners who are still trying to understand what Instagram is. Mm-hmm. Could you explain what it is and how one would use it?
Yeah, well, that's not crazy. There are a lot of apps. People have trouble keeping up with apps. Instagram is, at its core, a photo sharing app. So basically, you can take a photo on your camera or you can take a photo in the app. You can apply different effects if you want to. So you could add what's called a filter to give it like a cool retro look or to make it black and white. And then you share it, and you share it with people that follow you. And you can also follow other people. So if you're really into art, you can find all sorts of like niche artists on Instagram who are using the app to share what they're creating, or you could follow celebrities or lots of different people. So it's a social network, but it's really focused around imagery and helping people sort of get a visual voice.
So when you were growing up, social media wasn't really a thing.
Computers weren't really a thing. They were just beginning to be a thing.
Right, right. Brother typewriters with little digital, interfaces.
Yep.
So what did you imagine you would be doing for work?
I definitely never thought I would be in technology. And you and I were chatting a little bit before this. And the funny thing is, I do think for women in particular, but for lots of young people, when they think about working in technology, they're really thinking about coding, or they're thinking about, working as an engineer. And there are lots of different ways to work in technology. And so my job, which is more on the non-product, non-technical side of things, that is something I probably could have imagined, you know, because my job is a little bit like a puzzle. It's sort of putting all these things together to think about what the right solution is for the company. And that is something that I think probably would have always appealed to me. But no, if you had asked me, would I be working in tech, I would say no. But interestingly, I did go to film school as an undergrad. So film has always been a huge part of my life.
So what did you think you might work in film?
I think I thought I wanted to get like my MFA and teach film history. Like I love 30s and 40s black and white film. That is like my passion. And I think I thought I probably would have loved to teach. And then I realized I really didn't want to teach later. But I think that's where I thought I was going when I first started to study film.
And did you try and teach?
I did. I did teach. I don't know if it was like a solid effort, only because I moved to Japan right after I finished my undergraduate degree. And I was teaching English in a fishing village in Japan, in a really remote part of Japan. And I just got so much pleasure from the kids, and I loved them, and we had so much fun together. But it's a little bit of a different scenario because the immediate barrier you have is English, or Japanese in my case. So we never even got to some of the really rich sort of like linguistic interactions, but there was a lot of other cool stuff that came out of that experience.
But becoming a teacher was not one of them.
I think I knew that I like love kids. I love playing with kids. I didn't love the idea of like standing and sort of speaking and talking at people. I really liked the interaction. And so I'm probably better in sort of a team environment than I would have been as a professor. But who knows? I mean, who knows?
And who knows what's to come?
True.
So how did you end up in tech?
I ended up in tech almost by happenstance. I had come back, so I finished my undergraduate degree and I was living in Japan, and I moved to San Francisco because a lot of my friends were here. And it was in the early 2000s. It was right after the bust. There were no jobs. It was a really, really hard time. The economy was bad. I initially started tending bar on Haight Street, which was just an interesting experience coming back from Japan. And then I applied to a blind posting for a position with a company that was looking for people to sort of help with their budding advertising system. And so I applied to that posting and then later, much later, found out that that was Google. And that was the end of 2002, early 2003. So Google was about 5 years old at that point. And I got that job and then started at Google as a temp. I mean, really worked there for 7 weeks before they hired me full time. And so it really was complete dumb luck.
So what did that job turn into?
So that job turned into Google had just started supporting the website with advertisements. And it was looking at the advertisements that were coming in. It was a system called AdWords, which still exists today, and seeing if the ads complied with the policies that Google was setting. So, for example, Google did not want to be advertising guns. And so we would check to make sure the advertisements, you know, met the policies that they had. It's just so funny because this was all being done by humans, you know, with degrees and who were so hungry for jobs that they were willing to do it. And now, of course, so much of it is automated and it's done more algorithmically. But it was fascinating and it really gave me an exposure to how you create policies that work for lots of different people. And it really is like a puzzle. It, you know, there isn't one answer, and it's where you find the best answer for the company, for the people that are using your service. And that, I think, really interested me, that puzzle. And that was ultimately, I think, what started fostering an interest in public policy.
Fairly early in your career, you met Sheryl Sandberg of Lean In and Facebook fame.
Yep.
I think it's fair to say fame at this point.
She's I would ubiquitous. Agree. Yes, I would agree.
And so she's been a bit of a mentor to you. How did that come about? How did you meet?
So I when I started at Google in 2003, Sheryl was running what we called online sales and operations at that point. And I hadn't even met her, but I knew all about her. She just had this amazing background, leadership style, and everybody just gravitated to her because she was so inspirational. And she was really paving the way for Google to support its service with advertisements, which was huge at that point. Google wasn't the moneymaker that it is now. That was all just beginning, and she was really helping to lead that. And then when I finally met her, I was really young, and the thing about Sheryl was that it was really clear that I wanted to take the work that I was doing with Google and really do it in other offices. I wanted to be in international offices and I wanted to work with international teams. And I had expressed an interest in moving to India to start an operation in India and to start Google India at that point. And I think most people would have said no. I mean, she's 24, she's 25. And Sheryl said yes, she can go and she should do this. And then I did live in India for a year at that office, and she would come periodically, and that was how I got to know her better. But the idea that you can give people a chance and allow them to take a risk and really believe in them, and if it doesn't work out, you have the hard conversation, which is, you know, did this work out or not? But she was willing to sort of take that chance, and I really appreciated that at the time. So,
what did you do once you got to India?
It was really a startup. So even though it was Google, we didn't have any operations in India at that point. And so we were setting up an office so that we could provide more global support to people and not run everything out of the United States. We had to hire people. We had to get office space. We didn't even have any signage for the door. There was no toilet paper in the bathrooms. I mean, the whole thing was, it was do whatever you need to do to get this thing off the ground and to get people hired and to help the business grow. But my real job was helping to train people on what our policies were around advertising so that they could start taking over some of that work to support the international consumers.
So you were there for a year and then you came back to the States.
Yep.
And did you stay with Google at that time?
I stayed with Google. Yep. I was there for a year. I stayed with Google for probably another 2.5 years after that. And I knew when I was at Google that I wanted to go back to school. I wanted to do a graduate degree and I wanted it to be in technology policy and international affairs. And so I started applying for graduate programs. So I stayed at Google till 2007 and then left to do a degree at Columbia for 2 years in tech policy.
So and then you and Sheryl Sandberg were staying in touch throughout that time because did you end up going back to Google, or did you end up at Facebook where she then was?
I had a tentative agreement that I could go back to Google if I wanted to, but I knew that I didn't think I wanted to. I thought I wanted to try something new. So I left. I really left Google. I did my 2 years, and then I actually didn't keep in close touch with her, but I did bump into her, I guess, the summer between my 2 years of school. And she said, oh, what are you doing now? I said, I'm in school. I have no plans. And she said, oh, well, you know, I'm at Facebook, which I knew. And she was like, you know, you should come. You should come and check it out and see if you'd want to work here. And so it was in between my 2 years of school. I think I saw her in June. And then in August, I started interviewing. And by the time I went back for my second year of my graduate program, I had the job at Facebook. So I knew when I graduated, I was going to be at Facebook. So it worked out well.
I'm just curious, having a relationship like that with someone who has so much power and influence and so on clearly is an advantage in helping move a career forward. Mm-hmm. And it's not just because they like you, right? You've earned it.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm curious, have you ever sensed any kind of resentment or, you know, like, oh, you know, why is she so special among any of your peers as a result?
I don't think so. To be honest, very little of my interactions at Google and at Facebook were directly with Cheryl. It was more somebody who is in the background that I really respected and who knew me from working with me somewhat tangentially. But more of my work life has been about work ethic and pushing my career along and that kind of stuff. So hopefully that is what people see. I don't think most people would even know that relationship existed.
Until now.
Until now, exactly. Yeah, but, you know, but I also think that most people have somebody that has helped them get to a different position or to help them do something or just allowed them to take a risk. And hopefully people have that, and especially women and women in technology who really want to push themselves. And so that's something that I focus on a lot now is like, how do we allow more women to do that at Instagram? There are lots of women at Instagram who take on, I think, similar mentorship roles. So, yeah, I hope more of my work life is about results and work ethic and things like that.
But you've adopted this mentoring mentality for yourself.
Yeah, and I don't even know if it was like, well, I must mentor others. It was more, I get a lot of personal fulfillment out of working with a team, really being results-driven, pushing each other. Because when that works, it's just there's so much reward for everybody involved. And so when you see people that you think are just great and that you really want to help and that you want to push, you know, I think that happens somewhat naturally. But I do feel really committed to it also because tech benefits from diversity. And I think women are a really big piece of that.
So tell us a bit about your job as the director of public policy at Instagram.
So public policy has a lot of different components. And especially for me, it covers a lot of different things. So one thing it covers is, have we built in the right safeguards into the Instagram experience around things like privacy? Or if teens are using Instagram, do they understand how to share responsibly, that kind of stuff? So that's one piece of it, which is the product itself. And then there are campaigns that we run, which are really about showing how photography unites people and helps overcome stereotype and that kind of thing. And I would call them sort of social campaigns that we do that, A, highlight, I think, Instagram's value to people, but also helps people understand what we're about as a company. And that's something that I definitely focus a lot of my time on. But there's a pretty broad range of things that fall under public policy. And luckily, I work with a lot of people who own different areas and really sort of drive it all forward.
So you're working with different regions across the world, right? So mm-hmm. It's not just about privacy in the U.S. It's about what is Brazil consider private or
yep.
parts of Europe. So are you influencing how they're thinking about it, or are they influencing how you're thinking about it in terms of what they want for their citizens?
In terms of like governments
yeah.
and things like that? I think it's a little bit of both. I think if we just instituted privacy infrastructures that we felt like were reasonable, you would miss all of this like rich international perspective on how people feel about privacy in a country like France with a history of war, or how they feel about it in Germany or other places. You need to understand what that historical context is for privacy and why that matters to people. In the same token, I think it helps policymakers to understand that when you create a rule that privacy should work a certain way, there could be lots of unintended consequences. There could be things that maybe people don't think about. And so we can play a part in helping bring that perspective to the table. But at the end of the day, it has to work. The focus is and should be on the people that are using services like Instagram. I think it has to be. Otherwise, a lot gets lost.
Well, what's an example of some of the nuances that you found in working with France or Germany in terms of privacy policy? How are they looking at it?
Privacy is really interesting. Yeah, there are lots of great examples. I would say that, like, broadly, when you think about something like privacy, in Europe, they are only, like, you know, 70 years post-World War II, post-Holocaust, when people's personal information was literally used to persecute them. We don't have that cultural context here. Ours is actually quite different, where there's sort of like a standard, you know, freedom of speech, freedom of expression. I should be able to sort of say and do within reason what I want. And so if you just created policy taking into account how Americans think about it, that wouldn't be the right standard for Europe. And I'm trying to think of a very specific, a good example of this is in the U.S., because of our standard of free speech, it's okay from a speech perspective that you can say you don't think the Holocaust happened, right? You have the freedom to say that. Whether or not you and I think that's awful is a different story, but you have the right to say that online. In France, it's actually illegal to deny the Holocaust existed. And so then it's like, well, what do you do? What is the right answer from a policy perspective? And to me, that is the puzzle. In a way, how do you create a standard that both works for Americans and also works for people in France and Germany and other places where Holocaust denial is illegal? And that's just one example. For that example, there are lots of other ones that are really complex. And I find it fascinating because there are just so many different viewpoints on these things.
And so that's the sort of the question of, is it the company's responsibility to report that statement or to delete that statement? Are those the kinds of issues that you're...
Company's responsibility, and what do people who use services like Instagram and Facebook reasonably expect to happen? And if you're someone in France, you probably expect that Facebook or Instagram is not going to allow that kind of speech, right? That's just not part of what you're seeing around you. In the U.S., almost everyone I know would hate the idea of denying the Holocaust, but from a civil liberties perspective, from the perspective of do I have the right to communicate this? There are a lot of people who feel very strongly that you should have the right to say that if you want to. And so it's our job to figure out what the right mix is for the people who are wanting to do these things.
Whew, that's a...
Yeah, some light Friday.
Some heavy duty stuff.
Yeah.
What do you think the responsibility is for Instagram in terms of teens, like in terms of keeping teens safe, you know? And I'm just wondering if there's any analogy from a policy standpoint around like having a certain number of fire exits or, you know, requiring seatbelts in your car when it comes to teens.
Yeah. It's something that I think about a ton. Before I was at Instagram, I focused on child safety and teen safety at Facebook. So this is something that I like feel very strongly about. I think as a company, you have to make safety like the number one thing you think about. Not just because it's the right thing to do and because you want to keep teens safe, but also because it makes no sense for the business not to keep people safe. It makes no sense. People are not going to use any product or service if they can't reasonably expect that they're going to have a good experience and that they're going to feel safe. So in all ways, creating these environments for teens where they feel safe and that we are providing these fire exits or whatever we want to call them for them is super, super important. The flip side, or the other piece that I think it's important to remember, is that there are things that many of us think that teens need, and in reality, their needs may be different. So a good example is a lot of people say, well, teens shouldn't be able to share publicly on the internet. They shouldn't be able to. And I think it's really reasonable that, you know, you wouldn't want to give a teen a microphone to a planet of people. But with that said, there are a lot of teens, young teens who are social activists who are doing really amazing things. And the other thing is most teens who are using online services don't want to share with the world. They really want to communicate with the people closest to them, and they want to do it in small groups or on messages. And so I think it's really important to understand what they're doing and how we can support them in a way that makes sense for them, that keeps them safe, but that doesn't sort of take a blunt instrument to their rights to express themselves and their rights to communicate with other people. And that really is, it's not a balance, because I think safety always wins out, but it's something that you really want to get right.
In terms of your work life and your personal life, mm-hmm. It sounds like this is a big job. It's probably not a 9-to-5 job.
Mm-hmm.
Are you a night owl? Do you get up super early? How do you manage all of that? You got kids?
I do have kids. I have 2 young kids. What's funny is that my actual time in the office is roughly 9-to-5. Like it is roughly 9-to-5. I'm home by 6 o'clock every day with my kids. I'm pretty open about the fact I don't check my phone between 5 and about 8:30 or 9 o'clock. By the time we get them down, we have dinner. My husband and I can talk for 5 minutes before we move on to the next thing. And that's just something I've established. But I do work most nights somewhat late. And there are a lot of times where I'm up in the morning working earlier. But to me, as long as my kids are happy and secure and I'm getting that time with them, I'm getting that time with my husband, I really do enjoy the job. I really love the problems that we work on. It doesn't feel like a slog every day and night. It doesn't feel like a grind. I think it's more how you create balance, just to take walks or work out or to be part of a book club or read a book or whatever that thing is for you. How do you get the time to do that? And that's a challenge. I don't know any woman, stay at home, part-time or working, who does not need an extra hour to just unwind. You know, I think it's hard no matter what you do.
There was a point in your career when your kids were younger that you needed to take some time off, mm-hmm. a lengthy bit of time off. How did you navigate getting the leave that you needed to do that?
Yeah, when our younger son was 8 weeks old, our older son was having some trouble sort of developmentally. We couldn't really figure out what was going on. He had some trouble talking. It didn't seem like he understood words. We had to do all of this testing to try to figure out what was going on with him. And there was no question to me that I needed to go through that whole process with him and be home and talking to doctors and talking to everyone in his life about how we could best support him. I went to Facebook and just said, I know I need to take a leave. I think the question for me was, you know, they might give me 2 or 3 months or 4 months even, which is so generous. But is that going to be enough? Is that enough time in this boy's life to really get him set up? And I didn't think that it was. I ended up taking 9 months, and I was lucky that the entire time they were just like, you know, you just let us know how much time you need. And I came back to the same job. And so there's no doubt in my mind how lucky I am for that to be the case. That's just not the case for a lot of people, even when they work for great companies. But I think if push had come to shove for me, there was no question that he was the priority. So I did get really lucky. I would like to think that it's because they were invested in me in the long term, and that fundamentally made it worth their while to pay a short-term tax on a long-term gain. But I also think that Facebook, you know, feels, and I was at Facebook at the time, they feel really strongly about allowing some amount of flexibility, particularly like if you're a woman and you want to stay in the workforce, but you have something going on at home, like, you know, they want to try to make that work for you. And I do think that part of that comes from Cheryl and her leadership and just understanding that, you know, if you want to work, let's try to make it easy for you to work and to be the kind of parent that you want to be.
Well, Nikki, I've got to ask you an advice question. What is the best advice that you've ever gotten about getting the maximum number of likes on an Instagram post?
Oh my gosh, I don't even know. You're asking the wrong person. I publish photos of my children, and a good day for me is 40 likes. That's a great day for me. So I'm just ruining my street cred with everybody listening to this. The one thing I will say is authenticity is really the key to Instagram. You can tell when somebody is publishing their own stuff or sharing their own stuff, and it's funny. Sometimes the photos are imperfect. Even celebrities, like you can tell when a celebrity is really taking their own Instagram photos and they're sharing them in this authentic, really conversational, direct way versus their publicist or somebody else is doing it and they're referring to the celebrity in the third person. And, you know that that's not the person. It's just not as great of an engagement with the photo. To me, authenticity, I think, is key. But I have to tell you, you're asking the wrong person. Like, if you have any tips, I would love them. My kids are cute, but I think they're cute to about 50 people in our lives and not much more than that.
Well, then you're 10 short, right?
Yeah, exactly. I'm not living up to my potential.
Nikki, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
That was Nikki Jackson-Colasso, the Director of Public Policy for Instagram. That's our inflection point for today. Is there a woman changing the status quo you'd like to hear from? Let us know at inflectionpointradio.org. And while you're there, I invite you to become a patron of Inflection Point, like Tom Jacoby and Sabrina Moyle, who are helping bring the voices and views of powerful women to the ears of everyone. And you can too at inflectionpointradio.org. Inflection Point is produced at the studios of KALW Radio in San Francisco and delivered to public radio stations nationwide through PRX. Subscribe to our podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. Our engineer and producer is Eric Wayne. I'm your host, Lauren Schiller.